Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Lynn.
Oh, there you are. Yay. welcome, welcome, welcome. And good to see you this morning in the house of the risen sun with the sun rising here in Colorado. Is it rising out there where you are yet?
Oh, not yet. it's still a little dark with the standard time changing.
Yep. So what's up with you this morning?
Oh, well, yesterday my wife Nancy and I celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary and took the day off and went to Eugene and saw a really cool movie, actually. It was called Loving Vincent. Have you heard of it?
No, it sounds good, though.
It's real interesting. It's hundreds of artists hand-painted with oil painting all these frames that compose this well, it's kind of like a rotoscoping where you basically take live video and then you paint over it kind of thing. It was a wonderful movie that was, you know, a great art film just in itself for that, from that aspect. But, you know, the story of compassion, for the life of Vincent van Gogh using his own art, to convey the story, you know, it's really mostly about the kind of investigation of his apparent suicide, but, you know, it kind of leaves that question open in the movie, but, it's whether or not that really was the case, but, you know, it was a very compassionate film talking about, the sensitivity he had to everything and everyone and how he, you know, it was demonstrated that his life was, an exercise in looking and listening and it appeared to be judging not. anyway, it was just a really interesting film, and I recommend it to just about anyone who might be interested in something like that, whether or not they're interested in the life of Van Gogh, I guess is pronounced, the artist or not. Anyway, it was just a really neat film. And we saw it in a little tiny art theater in Eugene, and I think there was room for maybe at most two dozen people, probably more like 12, 16 people. It's just like we walked into this room. It was like, oh, wow, there's like four seats left, and we took two of them, and then promptly two other people sat down next to it. But, you know, again, like going to a movie is always just a great opportunity itself to remind yourself that we're in a big theatrical production that we call 3D reality, you know, a.k.a., you know, the world that we think of as our reality, so.
Real life?
yeah, the alleged real life, yeah.
The alleged real life, and what does it mean? What is that? You know, that's what I've been really seeing a lot lately is all the beliefs that I have about what real life is and what is normal and what is natural and what should be and what shouldn't be. And, man, you know, are we ever wrong? In every instance, it seems like, you know, I'm always – have been not confused, but mistaken about what was really happening and thinking the reasons behind things were, so logical. And, it just seems to me like I'm just seeing more and more and more how all ego thinking is so illogical. And mm-hmm. the recent lessons about, judgment are so, oh my God, they really hit home with me. I mean, not that, you know, I've done these lessons over and over and over over years, mm-hmm. but just this time that the true meaning of judgment really hit home for me that, you know, really it's every thought that I have, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, that is such an important point that you just made there, Lynn, because it really is moment to moment, everything that either cements us to what we think of as a positive or a negative experience, or anything that basically reinforces the belief in separation, that, you know, that I'm a separate body and, or even just a separate mind, you know, with separate values. Anything that really furthers that and anchors or cements our identity to that kind of thinking really is just silly. I mean, it's just, it really flies in the face of not only, I guess I could call it uncommon sense, but the awareness that both modern physics and certainly ancient Eastern mysticism and the contemporary, you know, spiritual psychology of A Course in Miracles all seem to converge, it would seem, on the idea that there really isn't anything out there, and that the only thing that we need to address is the contents of our mind, and specifically address that with a teacher that sees that the belief in duality and separation is bogus. And recognizes that that's just an erroneous perspective that has kept us, you know, metaphorically in the dark for, you know, the beginning of what we think of as time, which even includes the idea of time. So, yeah, like you said, like we really literally have misjudged and been wrong about everything. And that's considered normal. I thought this morning, you know, yesterday I was, you know, kind of doing the normal thing of going out and celebrating with my wife, you know, a normal occasion, like an anniversary. and we had a really good time and had, you know, a couple of nice meals out and interspersed with, you know, a run to Costco and a few other errands and things. But it was just kind of fun to just, you know, do normal stuff and at the same time watching my mind, you know, wanting to judge and evaluate and you know, make some things more important or less important than others you know, and it was really interesting because my wife and I had this really nice discussion actually about how we've, you know, both, even though she's not, doesn't profess to be a course student, she, you know, I think it's occurred to her, you know, and just because we're probably on similar paths in some ways, is that, you know, the idea of getting upset about what happens or what doesn't happen is really working against our interest. And I think that's intuitively obvious to anyone if you really, you know, stop and think about it. But we're the normal thing, and that's where it's important to define normal carefully, I suppose.
Yes.
Is, you know, the certainly normal for the ego is to find all kinds of things to condemn. And even watching this movie yesterday, I was thinking, well, the normal thing is to be upset by the injustices of the world. And certainly one could make the case looking at this film about the life of Vincent van Gogh, about how he was unjustly treated in various places in this film. You know, and it kind of reminds me of Ken Wapnick's commentary about the, you know, the grab bag of guilt and how we pull things out of our unconscious guilt to reinforce, that belief we have about ourselves. And that's very normal to the ego, but it's certainly not natural in terms of what our true nature is. And again, it's nothing, it's always a good reminder to not try to judge on the basis of behavior, but in terms of, you know, what our real feeling of peace of mind report card, so to speak, gives back to us. You know, if we can just kind of see, am I at peace choosing this interpretation about things? And if the answer is no, then we probably have been choosing the ego as our teacher, and our life will feel more like a prison than a classroom at that moment. So that's always an interesting criteria, isn't it?
And it is, and really interesting that from going and seeing a movie about an artist that I think we both really admire. In fact, my daughter just gave me as a gift, which some people may think this is, you know, really cool, and others may not. But a poster of I know if you're familiar with Doctor Who, I know you are.
Yeah.
The Vincent episode of Doctor Who. There's a painting that they show of Vincent, painted of the TARDIS, and it's kind of floating through time. And so my daughter gave me a poster of that painting. So I'm going to put it up on the wall because it's a Vincent van Gogh type painting of the Doctor Who TARDIS, and it's, excuse me. That's a very moving episode to me. It's probably one of my favorite Doctor Who episodes, in fact, because it is so compelling. When they think that, you know, they go back in time and hang out with him, and they think that through their interactions that they gave him a different choice, And yet he still committed suicide. And so, so they're back in the now pondering, you know, why that happened, even though they made changes or gave him different options and he still did that. Uh-huh. And I look at that and I'm like, well, yeah, you know, the script is written. You can go in there and, you know, change any effect anywhere in it. But, you know, the character has a life that already has been prearranged by a script that was written long ago. And so he could no more change that script than you or I can change our scripts. And instead of looking at it and saying it's a shame, which is how we look at these things, and say, oh, well, he committed suicide. What a tragedy. But doesn't Jesus tell us all death is suicide? We all die by our own choice, right, no matter what the circumstance seems to be. You know, whether it's cancer or a heart attack or getting shot in the head, doesn't matter. You know, it's all something that we participate in because we act out the script. That's it. We're just acting out the script. And it's not the you and I that is the reality of what's here. You and I are characters. I'm a character. And you know, you can say, well, don't say that. You're the Holy Son of God. No, I'm not. This character, Lynn, is not the Holy Son of God. The being that Lynn is, that is beyond all things, that can see these things and see them from a perspective that is completely neutral, that person is the Holy Son of God.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Yeah, because that's what we all are in truth, but we don't generally identify with that awareness that is the Holy Son of God, that is what we truly all are, that contrasts sharply, and of course, the miracles brings this out in countless ways, with the who that we believe we are. And, you know, the who that we believe we are appears to be born, in cosmic perspective, you know, a rapid, you know, fleeting a life, you know, this short
like
appearance.
A mayfly.
What's that?
Like a mayfly.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. And then it's snuffed out, you know, and by various means. But, you know, what can never die was never born, and vice versa. And that's the essence. That's the awareness, the spirit, the truth, the real love and beauty and majesty, if you will, of the essential nature of what we really are, which has nothing to do with, you know, our normal dream awareness. So if we could just kind of look at, you know, the contents of our minds and recognize that there is an identity there that we all have, and we're all, you know, has been said and quoted variously, you know, we're all fighting a difficult battle between these two identities, between these two thought systems. The one that's true, of course, is that awareness that transcends birth and death and physicality and the ephemeral dream of thinking that we could possibly take this infinite spirit and confine it to a small number of years and a you know, equally tiny number of a spatial volume that exists within a seemingly vast universe, but even that vastness is still finite. But what we are is beyond numbers and beyond space and time, but that's not the normal thing. That's not how we normally think of ourselves. So we have to kind of go beyond ego's normal to what is truly natural, and I suppose you could say normal for the Holy Spirit, which is how you know, asking ourselves moment to moment, how can I see peace instead of the more obvious interpretation of the script, which is the one that we all buy into when we're not at peace. If we could see peace instead of the ego's script, we realize that we're never upset for the ego's reasons, that, you know, are the ones that are handed to us by the world. But the real reason we're upset is because we think we have separated from that perfect oneness, and we think that paraphrased again, you know, that God is dead because of a result, the result of a choice in our mind that we made, and because of that misconception, we suffer horribly at our own hands. But it appears to be because we made up a world in which projection appears to be possible, that there appear to be things outside of ourselves. We also appear to be at the mercy of a cruel and indifferent and hostile and insane world, you know. And all you have to do is turn on the news or pick up a paper or open your computer and look at anything that appears to be going on outside and see, wow, there's all this stuff. And yet, you know, there's in truth, there's always an awareness that everyone has, even the most, seemingly, isolated and maybe defiant minds that suggest that there's a basis for martyrdom or feeling victimhood and all that kind of stuff. And in truth, if this is a movie, then Lynn and Bruce and Vincent van Gogh and any other seeming person that walks this world is walking a dream world, and accordingly, doesn't merit, anger or attack, because that's why those things, as the Course says, are never justified. Because if a dream is what we're observing, how could a dream merit attack? It doesn't.
Exactly. It doesn't, because you can't control a dream. This is the thing. You know, I know people do lucid dreaming and stuff. I've never been able to do lucid dreaming. I don't know how you do it, because anytime I recognize in a dream that I'm dreaming, I wake up. You know, I don't say, oh, I'm dreaming, let me go fly. I wish I could, but I just recognize, oh, I'm dreaming, what the hell am I doing? You know, and I wake up.
Oh, yeah, I totally get that.
So, and I think that's the truth in the dream, in this dream, too. Once you recognize you're dreaming, you will wake up. You don't just keep dreaming and saying, oh, now I recognize that I'm dreaming and this is all an illusion, let me continue to play in the illusion. No, you say, this illusion is difficult, painful, causes all sorts of inconvenience for this character to be involved in all these different things. And the fact is, the character will go on, the dream will go on with or without my participation. And this, I believe, is what Jesus is telling us in this course. When he says you need do nothing, what he really is saying, and over and over and over I see it, that what is happening here is beyond our, not only our need to control, we shouldn't have any desire to control it. You know, if you walk into the movie theater, like if you went to that Vincent movie and you went in there and you said, well, I think that they should have done it this way, and this person should have played that, and we should have, you know, his house shouldn't look like that, and none of these things should be this way. If you start reconstructing the movie during the movie, and I mean, that's what we do, is we try to reconstruct the movie during the movie, but because we're not happy with the script that we wrote. But if you start trying to redo that, then you are no longer you become convinced that that movie is real, mm-hmm. and that movie can be changed, and that it must be changed. And if by some coincidence something you desire to happen in that movie happens, you can say to yourself, oh, wow, I did it. And people do this all the time. You know, they think that somehow or the other they are personally responsible for something that makes a shift or a change in what they predict is going to happen. in the movie. Now follow this. Okay, so I think that using carbon fuels is causing global warming, and I think that global warming is going to cause the seas to melt, the ice caps to melt, and I think that global warming is going to cause this thing and this thing and this thing and this thing. So I'm predicting into a future of which I absolutely know nothing, a story, an idea of a thought of how if I was in control, this would be different. Okay, so I've established that I see something, I think I make a difference, and the whole reason I'm wanting to make a difference is because I don't like what I see. And remember lesson 268 where Jesus says to us, let all things be exactly as they are, and I'm going to stop trying to meddle with the things I think I see. And that's what that whole lesson is all about. I'm trying to be in control. Let me stop trying to be in control, please, and let you be in control. And so I can just relax and let things be. And that's, you know, kind of Jesus's message about this whole illusion, mm-hmm. is that you can't change it. You can't do anything about it. All you can do is forgive it. And forgiving it is actually accepting it as it is. And allowing it to be, not trying to manipulate or change it or make it any different. Recognize that what you see is not the truth, and what appears to be happening doesn't matter because it can't change anything that's real. Nothing real can be threatened, and nothing unreal exists. That's the very first thing Jesus tells us in that book. So he's challenging us on our version of reality. What is real? And so if it can be threatened, if it can cause death, if it can cause destruction, if it can cause hurricanes, if it can cause cancer, if it can cause, these are threats to the unreal. And we spend our lives trying to protect the unreal from those threats. When what Jesus is telling us is, that's not reality. And if you think with me, if you let me help you, you can think with me and see the truth and reality. And when you see the truth and reality, you will no longer be convinced that you can be harmed by the world. You will no longer be convinced that anyone or anything can be harmed by the world. You will see the truth and reality of yourself and your brothers, and you will actually be able to communicate with your brothers in that true state. Now, when that happens, actually you shift into another state of consciousness, and in that state of consciousness, as Jesus did when he shifted into that state of consciousness, where he recognized nothing real can be threatened and nothing unreal exists, he was able to walk the earth in a body that he manifested in order to be able to walk the earth. He was consciously doing it rather than unconsciously doing it as we do and believing that we are the victims of this body and at the effect of the world. Jesus was the master of the world, the master of the body. He could change water into wine. He could walk on water. He could walk through walls. He could just by being in the place of people, heal them, bring them into a state of oneness with the universe so that their actual physical bodies became purified and healed from diseases that they helped. Not because he was out there saying, sickness is bad and I want to heal you. He was out there saying, this is truth. And the truth and reality of what Jesus was what brought about healing. That was what brought about these, you know, what we call physical miracles. So this is the difference. Either I am at the victim of the world state of being, or I am at the master of the world state of being. And that's the choice that's being offered. So You know, that, I mean, that's what I see from A Course in Miracles is, you know, the script is written. You have a choice which part of the script you want to believe. And you can actually be, you know, you're not going to change the fact that you're, you know, you got cancer. You're not going to change that. You're not going to change these things because even if you have the power and ability to do it, you recognize that it doesn't matter. You recognize that there's no meaning to the threats of the world, to the body or the mind. And so you don't act or react. As Ramana Maharshi is a very good example. Although people thought, well, you're stupid. He was stupid for not going and getting chemo and whatever. They probably didn't even have that then. But, you know, treatment for his cancer, they thought it was stupid for him not to. And, you know, why would he do that? Because he knew that that didn't matter and had nothing to do with him. That was the physical body of a character. And he wanted to show people, this is a physical body of a character. It doesn't affect me. But, of course, people got their ideas about it anyway. Anyway, so that's my rant this morning.
Well, it's helpful because I think, and you said a couple of phrases that I thought were interesting, that are common phrases that we all kind of use and kind of indicative of the level of confusion in our minds. The two phrases that I heard were physical miracle and lucid dreaming. And both of them kind of imply that, you know, and we use those all the time, those kind of phrases, is that there's a reality in the world of space-time that is worthy of our identification. Doesn't mean we shouldn't address it on the level that we think we are in as you know, as humans. But the A Course in Miracles and any good, you know, pure non-dualistic metaphysical system, of which there are countless, as the Course points out, and that's why it's A Course in Miracles, not The Course in Miracles, would suggest is that we really have the opportunity in our minds to see beyond the illusion of duality. And the, you know, a lucid dream really just is an example of thinking that somehow we can have our identity, you know, vibrantly alive as a dream figure. But really what's really vibrantly alive in any kind of lucid dream experience, whether it's a nocturnal dream or, as A Course in Miracles would try to generalize, is if we become, you know, awake, aware that we are really the dreamer of the dream and not the dream figure, not the person that's having the experience in the dream, but we're the aware of being the dreamer of it. That's a whole different shift, isn't it? And, you know, and when you said physical miracle, it's like, well, the real miracle is in the mind and has nothing to do with physicality. And I think in the case of, you know, Jesus or Ramana Maharshi or I'm thinking of, you know, more contemporary, I'm not going to necessarily equate, Tomas Vieira with being a saint or anything like that, but I was watching his process at the end of his life a few years ago, and how he recognized he had a throat cancer of some sort, and recognized that was not his identity, and it was clear that whether it was a complete experience or not, that really doesn't matter. But he knew that the direction that he wanted to go in with that was to not identify with the physicality. And that to me is the real miracle, is this the shift in perception between identifying with something that's intrinsically limited and, you know, the dream figure, if you will, and instead identifying with the spirit or the essence or the awareness that knows beyond any kind of shadow of a doubt that there is the Son of God, if you know, using a term that you used earlier and the Course uses frequently, is beyond that. We are all as one eternal infinite being beyond space and time. We're bigger than the universe, and the universe is dwarfed into nothingness, the material universe. That's why there's an expression that I find helpful to look at, you know, all the various aspects of duality and ego's thinking. And if I find myself identifying with any of these, I realize, okay, I just need to change teachers again. And the acronym is GIST, or G-I-S-T for guilt, which is the whole thought system of sin, guilt, and fear. Individuality, which is the idea that my my seemingly separate self as a person, whether it's mentally or physically, is different or separate or better or worse than anything else. And then space and time. And space and time, of course, you know, covers all the whole turf of the illusory dream. And if I'm identifying with any separate aspect of those things, particularly as a body, I mean, as the poster child, I suppose, that's a clue right there that, okay, I've picked up the sword of duality and, you know, that divides and hacks and hews and cuts and carves and makes, you know, dices up and slices up what's really can only be oneness into these seemingly separate bits. And it's like, that's just silly, because that's the only way that something can appear to be threatened is if there's something outside or other than itself, and you can't do that without duality and division and divisiveness and dissociation of some sort, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. So it's the, I mean, really, that is the, it's the way we define our lives and our world and our thoughts, and, you know, and again, all these thoughts, this whole teaching of what is judgment, you know, the last judgment, what is it, you know, is coming to the place where you recognize that you really have, and this has been absolutely my experience, and I'm sure yours too, we really have no basis for any judgment of anything, and I'm meaning not just judgment, this is good or this is bad, judgment, this is this and this is that. It judgment that separates reality into different parts and gives them names and gives them roles and makes them appear to be somehow or the other important in one way or the other. You know, this judgment that says, I like this better than that, every bit of our life, every decision of our life is based on a judgment that says this is better than that. One is better than another. You know, I'm awake. I want coffee. Coffee is better than no coffee. Being asleep is better than being awake. Being cuddled up in my bed is more comfortable than sitting in my chair. You know, wearing socks is better than not wearing socks. You know, that you're, or if I'm hot, you know, I mean, that's a continuous reaffirmation that what is happening in this illusion is real. I mean, we're continually affirming it in our minds through our thoughts and our judgments and decisions, saying, this is what is. Uh-huh. And you know, Jesus tells us we don't even have a basis for that. Right. You know, it's all based on the past. Uh-huh. And you know, it's a state of mind that I can't even imagine personally being in when I no longer see the past. I got into an argument with my husband yesterday. It was so interesting because we were talking about all these situations where, you know, women and men are accusing other people of sexual harassment. And, you know, I was telling him, you know, this is not new or unusual or anything, you know, and I started telling him about situations where I worked, where, you know, men would come up to me and, you know, grab my breast and say, oh, I'm just looking for a pencil in your pocket. Or, you know, I went into a meeting one time with the big boss, big corporate boss, and he was in a meeting with a bunch of guys, investors from France, and they were, you know, having a high-level meeting, and I had to take some information to him. So I went into the room, and he looked at me, and he said, oh, Lynn, are you here to come and sit on my lap and tell me stories? Seriously. In front of all of these high-level people from France and, you know, corporate, and, you know, he's asking me to sit on his lap and tell him stories. That is humiliating for mm-hmm. anybody who has, you know, I mean, at that time it was like, I was just disgusted. And I just said, no, I'm here to give you this information for your meeting, and I've got to get back to work.
Good for you. Yeah, yeah.
But you know, what do you say in situations like that? So I was telling him about those things, and so we got into kind of an argument. Part of it, I know he was upset because I didn't come running home and tell him all these things, but I know he would have been very angry, you know, if he knew that people were touching me and you know, doing things. I mean, a lot of things. People did a lot of things to me. So we got into this discussion about things that happened like 20 and 30 years ago. And finally, I'm like, and it was like heated and angry. And finally, I'm like, well, wait a minute. I'm here now and you're here now. These things are not happening to either one of us right now. And all we're discussing is something that we cannot make any difference in whatsoever. You can't go back and change it. You know, you can't. And so why are we having this discussion? And you know, we both just looked at each other and just like, holy shit, you know, this is just the stupidest thing ever. And, you know, we just recognize it's stupid to bring up the past and try to repair it in the now. And, you know, what do we think is going to happen in the future? Is, you know, really that's all you're doing is trying to activate the past. At the same time, just forgetting about the very moment that you're in. And that's what Jesus keeps telling us over and over is, you know, you have no basis to make a decision on whether that was good or bad, right or wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not capable of making those decisions because we are not being informed by the one who really knows. So unless you decide that you're going to just let Holy Spirit inform you, and you're not going to make a decision about how you think, how you feel, what you imagine is happening. You know, if you can do that, then you can get into a right-minded place where you no longer are suffering from these thoughts. But until you make that decision and ask for the help, because that's always been my problem too, is I'll make the decision, but I don't necessarily ask for the help or accept the help when it's given to me. So the Holy Spirit will definitely help you stay in that right mind, but you have to make a determination that you don't want to be mad. You don't want to be holding grudges. You don't want to be attacking other people. You don't want to make somebody else feel guilty for their responsibility in whatever happened. You know, I mean, seriously, you have to have your right mind in order to make this work. And, So it is a decision that you have to make.
Exactly, and as you point that out, I mean this is a topic that, you know, the whole gamut of sexual assaults that have come forth in the last few weeks, and certainly dominating a large part of the news media. I think it's interesting because it like you say, it points out the fact that this stuff has been going on, you know, for millennia, because there is this pervasive belief that we're seemingly separate selves. And whether we identify with being a victim or a victimizer, you know, regardless of gender, orientation, or whatever, there's still the belief that something real can be threatened. And and that's the whole point, is we need to look at the world and without condemnation. And I think that's why, you know, in page 401 of the workbook, you know, it says forgiveness is quiet, merely does nothing. It merely looks and waits and judges not. I think that's just such an important reminder that we just need to look at those things that come up, whether it's, you know, a past abusive situation in a workplace or whatever. You know, and you know, obviously there are countless examples that we're now seeing coming forth, and actors and you know, public figures and politicians and you know, just all kinds of stuff going on with that, because it's sort of being unleashed because that now there's sort of cultural permission to do so. But as you know, point out, this is stuff that's been happening for a long, long time, and it's not like it's anything new. But the beauty, if you will, if that's not too much of an oxymoron to use that adjective, of it is that we now have an opportunity to look more objectively and with greater candor and hopefully compassion at all these things that are happening, and see that everyone has an opportunity to choose again, to choose a different teacher. And I think your example in your workplace was a great one. It's that, you just basically, responded with, well, I'm just doing my job and need to get back to work. By looking at it and saying, if this is a projection of my unconscious thoughts, whatever seems to be happening to us is really part of the script that we made up, doesn't justify the behavior in any sense of the imagination. And really, we need to bring those things out and continue to question, the motivation and the thought, the system behind those behaviors. At the same time, if we can be compassionate and just look without condemnation and in the mind, not necessarily on the level of form, because on the level of form, it may make sense for someone to resign or someone to be removed from political office by appropriate, legal means or whatever, all those kind of things. But since we're talking about the mind here, and it's really what's going through my mind, again, I keep coming back to one of the things that Ken Wapnick talked about Freud is, if dreams are the royal road of the to the unconscious, and our daytime dreams, which is includes the things that we get from our news media about abuse and of all forms, whether it's sexually or oriented or not, those become opportunities to look at the contents of our mind and see where we're still harboring judgments and grievances and thoughts of condemnation. And they just become one of many sources or tributaries to the incessant stream of ego jabber that you alluded to earlier in our conversation this morning, Lynn, of if we can just kind of notice that everything becomes a forgiveness classroom, whether it's, like you say, just am I wearing socks or not, or have had my cup of coffee, or would I rather be in bed than sitting in a chair, or all those kind of things. It's like, well, if I can just notice that I make big deals, and everyone can say this if they're honest with themselves, over those preferences, and those preferences suddenly become identity issues that we're going to go to war about, that's when the red flag has been raised, and we can say, aha. And not in any kind of, reinforcing the worth thing, but just saying, ah, there's the ego trying to pick up the sword again and make a battle where in truth none need exist. Because there's no opposites to truth, and therefore there's no warring factions. How could there be anything polarized in perfect oneness? And if truth is perfect oneness, right?
Exactly. And that's what we have to do, is just keep bringing ourselves back to that place, over and over and over. And, of course, you only recognize it when you're off the path. When you start wandering off the path and you get into trouble, then you're like, oh, man, I've screwed something up. I must have decided wrongly. I'm not at peace. Something's gone wrong. But, it's recognizing, and I think that's, over and over and over, you have to do that. I think, I think I've told this story before, that at school, the nuns used to tell us that the conscience, which is a big deal in the Catholic Church, is that you have a conscience, which means that, your ego is there to jab you whenever something you do something wrong or against the rules, and therefore you stay in line. You do what you're supposed to do. But, they would tell you that the conscience is like a little stone in the heart, and it has sharp edges. And every time you do something wrong, it turns and it cuts and it hurts in the heart. But if you don't keep that little stone sharp, then when it turns, eventually it will wear off the sharp edge and it won't hurt anymore when you do bad things. So, what we tend to do is to bring that little stone up and just sharpen the crap out of it so that it will cut and cut and cut and hurt and hurt and hurt. And we think that pain is telling us that we are doing the right thing. we're being good, we're being whole, whatever it is that we think we need to do. But that pain from the conscience, really is just another ego ploy that's there to keep you, in suffering. And, I don't know, do you watch this show called The Good Place?
No. I've heard of it. I think my wife has watched an episode or two, yeah.
No, you'll have to watch it, but watch the first season first. Don't start on the second season. Watch the first season first, and so I won't say anything and give you any spoilers. But, you know, just basically, we torture ourselves, and how we torture ourselves on a constant basis, and we torture each other on a constant basis, is through expectations and beliefs that things should be a certain way, and then when things fail to be that way, then we attack, and we're constantly doing these things to that sharpen little edge telling you all the time that you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're bad, you're doing things that are harmful, and if you don't keep that sharpened up, sure enough, eventually you'll stop seeing the wrongness in the things you do and think that they're normal and natural. And that's what the nuns were trying to teach us, is that you have to keep sharp to know that, the things that you're doing are not good. And of course, they had their own criteria for what was good and bad based on the teachings of the church. So, I grew up with a pretty good idea of what was right and what was wrong. But that didn't help me any, when it came right down to, looking at my own, my own life and my own behavior, because, I couldn't see a place where I felt like, that it was justified to just be continually attacking the world because I thought I was right. And that's what happens. You get to this place where you think, and I see it in the Course community all the time, this idea that, I know the right explanation, I know what Jesus meant, and I know what this Course really says. And so, if you're not living according to that, or you're not seeing things the same way, then that justifies me being able to attack you. And we use A Course in Miracles for the same thing that the church used on us for years and years, because that's a methodology that we learned that keeps us thinking that we're right and keeps us feeling okay about what we're doing because, the other person deserved that attack. And, someone mentioned that, and they constantly mention it. Why do Course in Miracles students seem to be so vicious to each other? Why do they attack each other so much? And it's that very thing that Jesus always asks us, would you rather be right or happy? And we can continually choose to be right. And, I even saw it in myself again yesterday in that argument with my husband that, several times, we would say, well, let's just stop this. And then I would always say something. Always. And my husband says, you always have to get that last jab in at the end. You always have to just get that last little thing in at the end. You always have to be right. You can't leave unless you prove that you were right. And it just hit me. Oh, my God, you're right. I am. And like, I would rather be right and leave feeling like, I've made my point and to heck with you. I do that all the time. I never even noticed it. I never realized it. But now I see. Yes, that's the ego always wanting to be right. So I said, from now on, if I do that, call me on it. And I'm going to try, obviously, to pay attention to it. And if I have the last word, maybe the last word is going to be, you're right.
Yeah. As you're saying that, I was picturing, you know, the fascination, especially, you know, the stereotype is young people, but I think we all have this fantasy role playing thing of, you know, being this sort of, you know, mythical warrior, you know, Avenger, you know, that's why that whole Marvel Universe, you know, movie series and the things like that, you know, are so popular, and all these, you know, superhero kinds of epics. You know, or become movie blockbusters is because we all want to identify with this. Oh, it's this seemingly separate self that's going to right the wrongs and fight the battles and avenge and, you know, restore justice and yada yada. But it's, you know, these are dream figures. And so, you know, like in the story that you just recounted of, you know, your conversation with your husband of wanting to be right. It's like, if we can just look at those tendencies to want to have the last word or to, you know, want to, you know, hang on to our judgments. It's really, you know, super helpful to look at that and to, as you, you know, started, you know, the early part of the conversation this morning saying is, you know, if we can just see that everything that goes through our mind is an opportunity to choose once again, to choose to drop the ego's sword and to not think that hero of the dream is going to solve anything within the dream, but to see that the dream itself is not the problem. It's the decision to want to dream and to identify with the dream that is really the cause of all our grief and angst and misery. It's just, you know, it becomes just silly. And then it becomes a much easier, quicker, gentler process to catch ourselves doing that and say, wow, I've been in battle again with an imaginary foe in my mind. It may, you know, and often is, it appears to be, you know, in the form of someone else, whether it's a life partner or, you know, a politician on the TV or on our computer or, you know, if it's, you know, somebody who cuts us off in traffic or, you know, all those, you know, countless little things that are really, all, you know, even the big, including the big things, that ultimately are all, you know, trivial. And that perspective, I think, really is so helpful. And that's really, going beyond the ego's normal, and finding our real nature. I did post a very short FAQ, in the room. I found another one that's much longer that maybe we should save for another time.
So which one do you want, the 113 or the 233 or the 634 or 1118?
The 634 I thought might be good to talk about. How about if I just read that real quickly?
All right, and I'm going to post it in the room or the link in the room.
Yeah, it's a real short one. I'll read the question. You can read the answer. How's that sound?
Okay.
Question 634, and this is from facimoutreach.org, and if you go through the list of questions and look up number 634, this is what I'm about to read. It's a nice short one, but it talks about normal and natural. And this one says, when I have a conversation with family or friends, it may become a real discussion in which we give our opinion about a particular subject. Since I'm a student of A Course in Miracles, I feel insecure about giving my opinion, especially when mine is different from others. I realize that the separation is there. I'm aware that I don't need to convince my friend. Should I keep my mouth shut? Well, there's a perfect question that ties into what we're talking about, doesn't it?
It does, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, the question is, does it make, you know, paraphrased here, I'm going to paraphrase it. is it important whether I do things on differently on the level of behavior? I think we can guess what the response is going to be. Do you want to answer? There's just a single paragraph.
And just before I read the response, you know, this is, I think, a lot of Course in Miracles students make, in fact, I did it myself, make the mistake of coming out and spouting a bunch of Course in Miracles stuff that you really, for me personally, I really didn't understand, and I really didn't, wasn't able to explain it in any kind of way that anybody else could understand either. But I believed it. So so just in general, a lot of times you may think that, you know, I see things differently because I'm a student of A Course in Miracles, but in general you don't. you don't actually see things differently, especially when you're first learning this stuff. It doesn't really change the way you see things until you start actually deciding that you don't want to see things the way that you have been seeing them and that the world sees them. You really want to see something different. And you may think that by being a student of Course in Miracles, that means implicitly that you are really wanting to see something different. But in reality, I think a lot of Course in Miracles students, including myself, just wanted to see justification for my own rightness. And so I know I used the Course originally a lot to point out to people how wrong they were. So even though I didn't understand it my own self, I was... I still knew it was better than what they were thinking. So anyway, just my own observations about my own behaviors, especially early on. But even now, you know, I still, and if you're a Course in Miracles student, you know, I may be trying to correct you too. So just recognize maybe I should keep my mouth shut. Anyway, let me read the answer. This situation could be a wonderful opportunity for you to practice what you have learned. As a Course student, you never want to forget to be normal, and normal people express opinions. So you can approach your conversations as a kind of laboratory in which you are going to learn how to disagree with someone without perceiving yourself as separate, without judging, and without the need to be right. This will happen if you show your ego the exit door and choose Jesus or the Holy Spirit as your lab director instead. And might I add, which I will, that when you show your ego the door and say, get out, I don't want to think with you anymore, you really have to make sure that that ego doesn't come back in. And you really have to watch your thoughts and watch your thinking to see that you're not doing it even when you think, I mean, it's so easy to fool yourself into thinking that you are doing what Jesus tells you to do, and then come later, recognize that you were just following the ego's orders and making up justifications for your rightness. That's been my experience. Anyway, so you show the ego the door and choose Jesus or the Holy Spirit as your lab director instead. You would then look forward to these occasions, and there would be less and less tension or conflict because you would have chosen the right teacher and the right purpose. And here's a quote from chapter 5, section 3. The Holy Spirit is the perfect teacher. The ego made the world as it perceives it, but the Holy Spirit, the reinterpreter of what the ego made, sees the world as a teaching device for bringing you home. And that's the end of the answer. It seems very simple, but as I'm sure you and I can both attest, it's not that easy. I wish it was.
It is extremely simple, but the ease, I think, comes eventually over time more and more as we realize that choosing the peace of the Holy Spirit's interpretation or translation, if you will, brings a much greater ease to our mind and a peace. Because there's no conflict there, and conflict is impossible in the Holy Spirit's, real alternative, because it suggests that if I don't take the dream that I made up seriously, I don't have to be at the mercy of what appears within that dream. I recognize that I'm actually the dreamer of the dream and not the dream figure. And if I'm the dream figure, then I'm identified with a wind-up toy that's no different from all the other wind-up toys that appear in my world that wants to be right and wants to make others wrong or some permutation of right and wrong. I posted a link to a Joni Mitchell song that I ran across the other day in response to another email I got, from somebody who said, here's one of my favorite songs from her, and I quickly remembered one that it was one of my favorites, and this one called Darkness and Light. If you haven't heard it, it's quite good. It basically talks about the insanity of trying to. I mean, this may not be you know, how she was thinking, but that's how I, you know, utilize this song in my mind when I hear it, is that, you know, the ego has everything backwards. You know, the, it looks at, what appears and makes it, you know, an object of persecution, instead of bringing us to the place of peace in our mind where we see that only, a belief in separation is, you know, the problem. And, you know, we can and ultimately must really use everything that comes across our mind. I guess I like to think of it as that we're not defeating the ego, because that uses, you know, the ego's own jargon to really reinforce it oftentimes. But if we can just watch like the, you know, the ticker tape or the scrolling message on the bottom of this TV screen and just watch that, it's not like that's going to go away anytime soon. But like you pointed out, Lynn, again, I'm keep coming back to the words of wisdom you shared at the beginning of our conversation this morning about an hour ago, that, you know, if we just look at how much, crosses our mind in even in a minute, that is fraught with, you know, propaganda for judgment. And that's the ego's ticker tape. It's just all this stream of blather of thinking, oh, I need to do this, or I could have done that, or I should be doing this, or oh, this is an irritant, or this bothers me, or I'm upset because. And it's, if the because includes anything in the world of space time, or, you know, the guilt individuality space time matrix, if you will, then we know that we're identifying with what's going scrolling past in that ticker tape instead of just adopting a more and more peaceful awareness and a gentle smile inwardly that looks at, you know, that interpretation that's scrolling past and say, you know, that's just silly. It's not evil, sinful, or wicked. It doesn't merit judgment. It doesn't merit condemnation. It's just silly. And that's, now we're talking again, a level of mind. On the level of form, you know, it may be appropriate, for example, if you're serving on a jury, to, you know, if there's someone who is, you know, whether it's a sex offender or you know, a burglar or a you know, a corporate criminal, you know, whatever, it doesn't really matter. If there's something that is seen, and that's part of this being normal subject, you know, if it seems that it might help people be more peaceful to have somebody locked up, in some cases, it may make sense to you know, go along with the the jury, so to speak, and, you know, incarcerate whoever for whatever reason, kind of thing. If that really is you know, truly helpful, but we don't have all the basis to make those judgments. So the important thing is can we just, you know, do what's normal, be aware that the world is designed to keep the adversarial, antagonistic, and warlike, you know, script in front of our face, front and center 24/7. And just notice that every time we invest in, the ticker tape script as our identity, we're gonna drop out of the feeling of peace. And we'll need to you know, climb back above that battleground. And see that's not the whole screen, that ticker tape that we've fixated on, for lifetimes. There's a much bigger perspective that includes, a very gentle, compassionate awareness for everyone that, you know, these, the sex offenders that are making the news and some of whom are coming forth and admitting these things and their complicity in some of these things, as well as the people who were the so-called victims, of these so-called victimizers, you know, it's really basically, you know, either a call for love or an expression of love. And if we recognize that it's a call for love, we may say, well, it's very appropriate that this person resign or is prosecuted or whatever. On the level of form, but on the level of mind, everyone is a completely innocent aspect of the Son of God and an awareness that is, for whatever reason, believing that they've identified with a seemingly separate self and is appearing to suffer as a result of that choice. But that appearance is what we need to look at. And so that's why it really is helpful that these stories come forth in the news. And, you know, you were talking about your experience in the workplace. I've been married 3 times and, you know, 3 out of 3 of the wives that I've had, you know, have all mentioned similar kinds of experiences, not only in the workplace, but in other situations socially. And it's not like it's a new story. It's not like it's anything that hasn't been happening for, you know, countless millennia. But that's because it's just part of a much larger dream story of belief that separate interests could possibly help us. And the separate interest, whether it's sexual gratification or financial advantage, you know, or, you know, literally, you know, plundering a country's resources or the bodies and material assets of a person or a country or anything in between. It's like that whole concept is really based on an insane premise that we could possibly be less than perfectly fulfilled and innocent and at peace. Well, I've kind of blathered on for a while.
You're absolutely right, and that's exactly true. And this is why, I don't want to maybe throw out the challenge here, but I guess I do want to throw out the challenge that we are miracle workers. You and I and everyone who's in this room and everyone who's listening to this recording or listening on the radio, we are miracle workers, and our job is to forgive. Our job is to accept the atonement for ourselves. Our job is not to look out at the illusion and condemn it, or any part of it, or any being in it, or anything about it. Because as miracle workers, our understanding or knowledge or what we believe about this world is that it is an illusion and it's not really happening. And so if you're condemning what's not really happening, then your miracle working is going to be a little bit flawed. You know, you're not going to be able to have an open mind and able to see what is happening, that you can have compassion, that you can have true empathy, that you can, you know, look at the actors and not look at the characters and recognize that they are not the actor, that what is appearing before us is an illusion. And therefore, I can relate instead of relating body to body, personality to personality, ideology to ideology. I can relate Christ to Christ, Christ mind to Christ mind. And if I look at any of the characters and recognize that beyond that particular vision, there is the Christ mind that is always there, always in control, always managing as perfectly as possible. When I see that, then I don't have to condemn what I see. I recognize that it is a story and that it's all here for my learning. It's a classroom for me. The purpose of the classroom is not to keep me in the classroom. The purpose of the classroom is to show me that there is a world beyond it, and to also show me that the brother that I trust, who is one with me, I can truly trust, because the Christ is the motivating being that is truly there, not the ego personality. So if I stop hating the ego personality and start just loving the Christ mind that's in my brother and myself, there is no conflict. You know, I'm not going to look and say, oh, you're making a big mistake, things are going to go bad. You know, I'm going to see that nothing that occurs here is going to have any kind of an effect on anything else, because illusion cannot affect illusion. It's all missed. It's nothing. And, you know, and you'll say, well, yeah, but we still live in this world. you know, that may be our perception that we still live in this world, but the truth and reality of it is that we don't. And the truth and reality is that I can trust the world. I can trust, I mean, look at the characteristics of a teacher of God. And you'll see exactly how Jesus expects you to act. You'll see exactly how Jesus expects you to interact with your brother, how Jesus expects you to interact in the world, how Jesus expects you to interact with yourself. You see those things. Those things are his instructions for us as miracle workers for how to be. And so, you know, I don't have to be running around saying the sky is falling because I know there is no sky. You know, I know. I may be thinking, oh, you know, global warming is destroying everything. But truth is, there's no such thing. These are all dreams. And so, you know, to see beyond the dream and to recognize that I can't be harmed. I can eat all the GMOs I want. I don't have to worry about sunscreen. You know, I can do whatever I want. The body itself may have a reaction to those things, but it doesn't change who I am. And it doesn't change who you are. And so that's my goal, is to see you as the Christ and to recognize that no matter what your behavior, no matter how you appear, that you are the Christ. And if that's my goal, then how can I be deceived? You know, if every time I start to get into, you know, some blame or shame or, you know, thoughts of attack, if I can just remember and bring myself back to that truth, that little conscience in my heart turns and cuts another notch, and I'm like, whoo, you know, I got to stop that shit. I forgot who I was for a minute. You know, just keep you reminding yourself over and over and over. And the, you know, someone was asking on Facebook, you know, well, what do I do if I see something, you know, somebody beating somebody up or, you know, somebody tries to kill me? Well, you do whatever you do. You know, you don't just stop and say, well, Jesus, what would Jesus have done in this situation? Jesus let him kill him. You know, Jesus said, okay, you know, whatever you're going to do, you know, that's the script, and I'm not fighting it. I'm not answering your questions or giving you any satisfaction. You know, I could have said, you know, please don't kill me, and I'll fess up and do whatever you want. You know, he could have done any of those things, and he didn't. He just stood for the truth, and he didn't care that they did that. He didn't care they crucified him. He didn't care so much that he came back and walked around and said, look, this is what happens. You cannot kill me. And you cannot kill you. And if
I think it's important to note, you know, as you're saying that, that you know, there's no call whatsoever for martyrdom.
No.
And of Course in Miracles. And that's, even though it's not about behavior, again, since we've been talking about being normal, it's if, you know, if there's something that is an issue that you feel that, you know, again, having, you know, ideally asked Holy Spirit for guidance first, and inevitably the response is never going to be about the specific, but it will be a way, it'll be a response within that addresses the specific with what is a general solution in the mind, which is always choosing to not identify with the dream in one way or another, that frees us to then do whatever behaviorally is appropriate and normal, whether it's, you know, an act of self-defense or whether it's signing a petition to you know, impeach or incriminate or whatever, you know, or incarcerate, whatever. You know, it doesn't really matter. It really matters only in the mind to what thought system, what teacher we're choosing to see the world within any given moment. So the script and its world really is not the point. And so wanting to change the script or to be, I think it's easy to kind of get into the sort of the blissney frame of mind, as Ken Wapnick would say, and what you were just talking about, Lynn, seems like it's, you know, an easy kind of step into that, if you will, to say, well, oh, it doesn't matter. I don't need to take care of my body or my family or my community. But it's not about that at all. It's basically saying that if I am upset by what happens or doesn't happen in the world, that's what I need to look at. And that's what I need. If I'm condemning myself or someone else for what appears to have happened to have not happened, then that's, my clue that I've, picked up the sword and now following the propaganda of that insane teacher in my mind, the ego, and I don't need to condemn myself. I just need to look at that and say, wow, that is truly, from a very logical perspective, totally ineffective. It's not getting me the peace that I really want.
Exactly. And that's very true. And you don't have to make a choice of anything. If you're in your right mind, you're going to do the right thing. You know, that's the thing. If you're in your right mind, you're not going to have to make a choice because there's only going to be one choice, and it's whatever it is. And you recognize that you can't change the script. It's, it was written long ago. All we're doing is watching it. And that movie Arrival, I was watching that movie Arrival the other night, and I got a kind of different, another depth of that particular thinking, but I'm not going to go into that right now because that's a long discussion. It's the mind that you're thinking with. It has nothing to do with the actions or activity. And so I'm thinking about when Byron Katie was, some guy came up to her and put a gun to her, and was going to kill her. And, the way she looked at it was not, oh, please God, don't kill me. I want to live. She was looking at it as she couldn't let him do that to himself. She was looking at a person who was suffering and afraid and in a lot of pain, and mm-hmm. she could not allow him to do something that was going to cause him even more suffering and fear and pain. She would not have minded if he shot her and killed her. That wasn't her fear. Her fear was that he would suffer greatly from guilt and shame, and probably even kill himself if he did that. And so she was looking at it more in a way of how to help her brother out of a fearful place mm-hmm, rather mm-hmm. than how to save her own life. She wasn't in a fearful place. And so she had the confidence and the strength of knowing that, if I die or not, it doesn't matter. My brother's excuse me, sanity is the important thing here. And being kind to, someone who is obviously in a great amount of fear. Mm-hmm. So, that is the kind of a point of view. If I could be in that point of view where, someone, does something to me, and instead of viewing it as an attack, I look at it and say, what is it that I can do to help this brother through this fearful thing? That automatically brings me into that one-mindedness right. where I'm no longer in conflict in my mind about what I want. I'm not saying I want my life, I want my body, I want you to be in trouble, I want, whatever it is. I'm saying all I want is the best outcome for everyone, and I want the peace of God. And the peace of God says, there's nothing to fear. It completely shifts the way you see things.
Exactly. And as you're saying, I was thinking, the kindness that A Course in Miracles talks about has, again, nothing to do with behavior. It oftentimes manifests that way, like in the Byron Katie example you just suggested. But it's really the kindness of letting everyone off the hook in terms of our evaluation of their identity, which means that we're evaluating our own identity the same way. I love Gary Renard's Fearless Love exercise in that audio, where he suggests that, if we can remember once in a while, maybe more often than once in a while, that to see each person we meet as not part of spirit, not a fragment or a partial aspect of that perfect oneness, but all of spirit, if we could remember that everyone is a representative of that completely inclusive spirit, of that completely inclusive oneness, that essence that we all share, then we would let everyone off the hook, because we would see that the dream figures that are populating a dream in our mind are not accurate representations of the infinite spirit that we all are. And so that distortion, you know, gently laughed at in my mind, lets everyone off the hook, including myself. And that is the kindness, I think, that the Course talks about. And occasionally, and you know, probably more and more often as we address that inner kindness, it can express behaviorally, and often does. And I mean, you know, we do things that reflect the awareness that, you know, I don't have to make a big deal about X, Y, or Z, whether it's, you know, something that is happening under our own roof with a life partner or family member or an office, you know, colleague, whatever. Or it can be, you know, something that when we see something happening on in the national or global media or, you know, regional, whatever, we see that, you know, that's just another example to forgive the contents of my mind at any given moment. So.
Well, exactly. And that's, you know, why Jesus, you know, once you get to this place where you're at least noticing, evaluating, deciding, you know, recognizing when you're not at peace. You know, you have all these incredible tools that Jesus has given us in this course to work with these things and to forgive these things and to make yourself a new habit of how to act and react. I notice it myself that, you know, sometimes I will forget. And all of a sudden, I'll be thinking things in the way that I used to think. You know, I'll be jealous or being angry about something that I'm like, you know, that I thought I had given up the idea of. And what I see is that it's a pattern. It's a habit. The world has told you are good or bad or right or wrong. And so, you know, when I go into those habitual behaviors and I don't even notice it until I'm kind of halfway down a path of being jealous, I think is a big thing with me, or being upset or thinking someone's wrong, or, you know, I'll just be going down that path and all of a sudden I'm like, holy crap, I thought I was over this. And then look and see, oh yeah, you know, somehow or the other, I threw some, you know, whatever decision I made personally, all of a sudden I have been deciding to be angry. I've been deciding to be jealous. I've been deciding that I like one thing better than another. And it's all, I can look and see that every decision that brought me to that point where I was all of a sudden feeling like I was caught or lost or hooked up in that old behavior pattern again, back into that old behavior pattern. And, you know, that I recognize is just a little glitch, really, because as soon as I recognize it, I can jump right back up into the right-minded thinking where I recognize that all those things I was condemning are not even really happening. But, yeah, you know, it takes some attention. You have to pay attention, and you have to not want to be mad. That's the other thing that I've seen, is that there are sometimes that I just say, screw it, I don't care what the Course says, I don't care what Ken says, I don't care what anybody says, I want to be pissed off. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to be right. I want you to suffer. I want, you know, whatever it is. I mean, I'll get into that, like, it baffles me. It's mystifying as to why I would do that. And yet I do it purposely. And I don't even try to justify it anymore. I just recognize, oh, you know, there's that thing again. I did it. I did that thing again.
We've wanted to distort reality and make it something it's not. Hey, can I read a short quote from...
Sure.
from the text. I just got inspired to just flip open the book, and I turned to this paragraph from chapter 18, section 3, The Light and the Dream. This is the third paragraph on page 378. And I'll just read this, because I think it kind of, you know, it's everything's interconnected, so I could really have picked any phrase and, you know, or paragraph in the court. But this one I think fits nicely in terms of, you know, that letting go of the cruelty that we perpetrate on ourselves and seeming others. Anyway, and this one says, truth has rushed to meet you since you called upon it. If you knew who walks beside you on the way that you have chosen, fear would be impossible. You do not know because the journey into darkness has been long and cruel, and you have gone deep into it. A little flicker of your eyelids, closed so long, has not yet been sufficient to give you the confidence in yourself, so long despised. You go toward love, still hating it, and terribly afraid of its judgment upon you. And you do not realize that you are not afraid of love, but only of what you have made of it. You are advancing to love's meaning and away from all illusions in which you have surrounded it. When you retreat to the illusion, your fear increases, for there is little doubt that what you think it means is fearful. Yet what is that to us who travel surely and very swiftly away from fear? So I think that kind of fits nicely with, you know, that it's just being normal in the world is totally independent of being natural in the mind, and we can afford to gently shift our awareness and our identity away from the fear and the cruelty of the ego and the darkness of the ego to the love that really is behind all appearances, and not push it away quite so readily each time, and allowing the really beautiful loving reality of what we really are, each of us characters, each of us artists in this elaborately painted dream, like the Loving Vincent movie we saw yesterday suggests, you know, that it's just an elaborate production about an elaborate production that exists in the mind only, and there's a reality behind each of us artists and each of us dreamers that have made this thing up that is profoundly wonderful and beautiful and healing and soothing in the sense of the word sooth as soothsayer. You know, it's the soothing that the truth of what we are really does soothe our mind as we embrace it and don't push it away. So anyway, well, thank you, Lynn, as always, for sharing another hour and a half with me.
Thank you, Bruce. And that, what was that paragraph again that you just read? Because I know the first part of it, if you knew who walked beside you, fear is impossible. But mm-hmm. that last sentence was a doozy.
Yeah. That's on page 378 in the text, if you have the, you know, second or third edition. And it's the third paragraph from section 3, of which is The Light in the Dream, which is from chapter 18, The Passing of the Dream. So
very cool. Yeah, because let me go see chapter 18. I'm looking.
The last sentence is, yet what is that, you know, what the fear, in other words, to us who travel surely and very swiftly away from fear, you know.
Yes, you know. And that
the illusion just becomes a gentle classroom. And I think that's ties into what you said earlier, Lynn, is that, you know, the world becomes really a healing place. Not that in and itself the healing happens there. It happens in the mind. But we use the world as a classroom to see the contents of our mind and gently return to the decision-making point where we believe we chose – we believe we chose a reality that is totally bogus, and that we're helpless to do anything about it. But in truth, at any given moment, we can let go of a silly dream and forgive ourselves and be home. So I'm always reachable at acimblog.com, and look forward to conversing next week, Lynn. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. Have a great week.
Likewise.
And we will talk to you next week.
Have a great one.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now.